Mitchell, getting weirder. After a show one night in Cleveland, we're all in the parking lot of a hotel getting ready to go to the next city on our tour. Mitchell approached me and said, "Bro, I saw the light around you tonight, bro. It was a circle of Jesus, bro. Here, I have a Polaroid." He handed me a picture of myself with stage lights on behind me. I didn't know what I was supposed to say in response. I'm sure I was like, "Oh, wow, cool. Thanks for this Polaroid of me and Jesus, Mitchell." And then a few nights later, Mitchell went missing. We had just played a club in Boston called Spit, and Mitchell was nowhere to be found. We waited outside the club for hours and then said, "Fuck it. He's a grown-up. He can figure out how to make his way from Boston to our next show," which was in Philadelphia. Greyhound and Amtrak are pretty easy. We didn't hear from him until he showed up just before soundcheck at the club in Philly. He gathered us all together to explain what had happened to him.
"Bro, when we were all walking out of the club together in Boston, all of a sudden, bro, I got kidnapped by these two gay white Aryan fags, bro. They took me to their basement apartment and forced me to do coke with them all night. They said they were gonna cut my thumbs off, bro. When they went out to get more blow, that's when I made my escape."
This is actually what Mitchell told us, for real. So which part do you like best? The gay fag part, the white Aryan part, or the two cokeheads that kidnap people and force them to sniff their expensive drugs? I like the escaping from the basement part best myself. We did our sound check, and then a bunch of us ended up in the dressing room talking about Mitchell. This dressing room is the size of your bedroom. Not huge, it's empty, except for some folding chairs. It's a perfect sunny summer day, and the windows are open. There's a fire escape right there. We started going off on Mitchell, tearing him up, making fun of his gold chain that no one would want to steal, the circle of Jesus, being forced to do coke, all of it. We were loud and laughing and talking mad shit. Then all of a sudden, we hear the sound of a toilet flushing, and out comes Mitchell from a tiny bathroom connected to the small dressing room. He'd been in there the whole time and had to have heard everything. It was so fucked up. And what did we do? Did we say, "Oh man, Mitchell, so sorry you had to hear that. We were kidding. We're over-exaggerating. We're assholes"? No. We all ran out of that room any way we could, out the door or out the window and up the fire escape. We scattered like rats in a basement when you turn on the lights. We never, ever talked about this incident with Mitchell. We all just pretended like the whole thing had never happened. It was ice cold. A couple weeks later, we got to Dallas, Texas. It was the last show of this particular tour, and then within a week or so, we'd start a long tour in Europe. In that dressing room in Dallas, Mitchell broke down crying.
"Bro, I can't go. I can't go to Europe with you brothers. I just can't. Look, I got your back on the stage and in the streets, but I just can't go with you brothers."
He was sobbing. We were like, okay, enough. Don't worry about it. Just stop crying, please. It was actually kind of fucked up and unprofessional because now we had to find a new percussionist and teach them all our songs and practice with them on the few days off we'd had for months. When you're on tour for a long time, you cherish that few-day break, and Mitchell was impeding family and friend and dog time. But it's just, he was such a fantastical yarn spinner that none of it really mattered after all. Mitchell made things totally weird and funny and memorable, and there's nothing worse than not being memorable. And then all of a sudden, Mitchell was gone.
Maybe Don't Play Basketball While High on Mushrooms by Michael Diamond, read by Talib Kweli. A Tribe Called Quest was based in NYC but came to L.A. often, and Q-Tip would invariably end up at G-Sun, probably because we had that basketball hoop and it was just fun to hang and smoke pot and listen to records and play basketball. Sometimes he'd bring Africa Baby Band from the Jungle Brothers. We loved Tribe, but damn, the JBs were on some shit at that time. We couldn't get enough of Straight Out the Jungle, their first album, with its anthems Jim Brownski and Because I Gotta Like That. Their second album, Done by the Forces of Nature, was even better, a psychedelic, adventurous record that was more experimental stone soul jazz poetry than rap. We played that record over and over. Tip and Africa were close friends but also competitors in music and in basketball. Especially in basketball. They'd show up sporting African medallions or Zulu beads and dashikis with Timberland boots on their feet and tie-dyed bandanas around their heads. Or maybe the Eddie Murphy Golden Child hat. And then go hard in a sweaty, heated game of one-on-one. Without changing their outfits. That shit invariably got to the point where they'd be dripping in sweat, shoving and yelling at each other. Things would escalate and cool down. Neither of them bothered to take off those clunky boots. It's a miracle that no one broke a toe. And then, there were times they'd play when magic mushrooms were involved. Those games would take forever because nobody could hit a shot.
We met a Tribe Called Quest through the captain. Q-Tip listened to a lot of the same records as us, searched for the same beats and grooves to sample at the same record stores and swap meets. The search was an infinite crate digging until the edge of the earth quest for anything and everything that could be sampled or even just inspire an idea. Everything from Idris Muhammad to Alice Coltrane to Witch. We really love Tribe. They are kindred spirits on a mission to make rap music that was as creative and free as the music that we had discovered, listened to, and sampled.
We always wanted Q-Tip to get on a track. Earlier, when we were making Check Your Head, he was a little apprehensive, or maybe just conflicted. License to Ill wasn't exactly cool anymore, and Paul's boutique kind of bricked on the commercial front. But during the Ill communication sessions, he was in the studio one day and heard a song we were working on that made him instantly light up. The track, which still didn't have vocals, was something I put together on my Akai MPC-60 sampler. The MPC-60 and the similar Emu SP-1200 were revolutionary. Before those two machines came out around 1987 or 88, digital samplers only let you sample about 1 second of material. Not a metaphor. Real talk, people. It was actually 1 fucking second. If we wanted to loop something when we were making License to Ill, we had to make a literal tape loop. Like, we'd wind a quarter-inch audio tape between machines and around shit in the control room so the loops would be just long enough that they'd play consistently and not warble as we recorded them. On Paul's boutique, we could still only sample 2 or 3 seconds, and that was only because the Dust Brothers were geniuses. But with the release of the MPC-60, even an idiot like me could record and sample stuff relatively easily. The track the Q-Tip liked was very simple, a beat I had looped with a weird synth thing laid on top of it. Its simplicity may have been the reason he liked it. A lot of the great rap productions we all loved had been minimal and raw, mostly due to that era's low bit rate and limited sample time. Reduced as much as produced. After Tip perked up, we looked around for a sample to add to the basic track. Both Beastie Boys and Tribe were listening to a lot of jazz then. In our band, we were all pretty obsessed with Miles Davis' amazing freeform psychedelic funk jazz record On the Corner. Another discovery was this obscure album by Eugene McDaniels called Headless Heroes of the Apocalypse, an out-there jazz-funk LP from the 70s. Tip knew and loved it too, so we kept trying to find a sample from it that would work on our track. Eventually, we took a line from the song Headless Heroes. Get it together, see what's happening, and dropped it in. It was super weird, and worked perfectly. By now, Tip was feeling it. We handed him a mic, and he just went to work. Tip's voice is totally original, stylistically and in his tone and cadence. He only did a few passes and then had to bounce. We ended up editing his freestyle, which gave it structure and allowed us to rhyme on there too. The finished track, Get It Together, managed to mirror in subtle ways some of Tribe's stripped-down hip-hop with plenty of low-end and touches of funk, boom-bap, and out-there something. And to this day, when I see Q-Tip, we laugh about that session.
Sabotage by Michael Diamond and Adam Horovitz, read by Tim Meadows. After Check Your Head came out, we toured a lot. Mark Nishida played the whole tour with us, and Mario was the front of house engineer. We'd also settled in with the regular percussionist Eric Bobo. By the end of that cycle of touring, we'd grown comfortable with the musical language we developed together, and we wanted to keep that going. So instead of taking a bunch of time off after the tour, we decided to start recording again. Yauch lobbied for us to do the first stretch in New York. He missed his friends and family, so we booked a couple of months at this kind of old and neglected studio called Tin Pan Alley.
Fun fact, the Fat Boys recorded All You Can Eat at Tin Pan Alley in the mid-80s.
This time around, the process went a bit like this. We knew that we'd start by playing our instruments live, improvising ideas, playing around with stuff. Mario would record us as we went along, mixing a bit on the fly, adding effects or live dubbing elements, and noting what might be a keeper of an idea. We'd sample some of the things we played and put songs together based on that, sometimes just keeping the original recordings and sometimes replaying sections or a song in its entirety. Then we'd add lyrics and otherwise turn the pieces into songs. In short, we weren't feeling the need to totally break all the rules of what we had done. We were happy to expand on them a bit. One day early in the process, we were about to start working, and Yauch started playing this incredible bass line on his vintage Fender Jazz bass. I remember it vividly because I immediately asked him, "What song is that from?" It sounded so good that I felt like it must already be somebody else's. Turned out it wasn't. He just come up with it. So I started playing drums, and this double beat break was the first thing I came up with. Those two elements are what you hear at the beginning of Sabotage. We wrote the rest of the music in a matter of hours. Horovitz added those great, simple guitar parts.
"You know I'm going to hear this. It's a little passive-aggressive, don't you think? And such a drummer thing to say. Oh, that guitar playing is just so simple. Shame on you, Michael."
We recorded it at the end of the day or first thing the next morning. There was an engineer at the studio named Chris, something or other, and he was a super nice guy, but not particularly a b-boy head, meaning he was indifferent about the music we were making. He was just at his job. But when Yauch and Mike started really playing this track, Chris went nuts for it and was like, "Yo, that is the song." I guess the track touched him and he couldn't keep his feelings for it inside. The track sat around for months without vocals, known only by the working title, Chris Rock. I vaguely remember Yauch wanting to just keep it as an instrumental. We tried to make it a rap song and the hook was a scratched-in sample of Queen Latifah saying, "Get live, all right." Would have been nice for a different track. This one called for some good old-fashioned screaming for sure. We'd been in the studio every night for so long making No Communication and Check Your Head, and we were totally indecisive about what, when, how, and why to complete songs. Mario was getting frustrated. That's a really calm way of saying that he would blow a fuse and get pissed off at us and scream that we needed to just finish something, anything, a song. He would push awful instrumental tracks we'd made just to have something moving toward completion. My favorite memory of him blowing a fuse, I was standing next to him and some piece of electronics wasn't working right and he was getting more and more frustrated, trying this or that or testing something, just trying to figure out what it was that was making that electronic thing not work. He lost it and decided to himself, not aloud, that it was the power strip that a bunch of things were plugged into. So he manically unplugged the electronic things that were plugged into the power strip, opened up a nearby window, and threw the strip out of the window, all the while saying, "God bless America," in that voice that you use when you're on the verge of an angry fucking breakdown, but you're not whispering or shouting. The words are pushed through your teeth. Mario had gone to Catholic school and didn't like to curse. Eventually, we brought the music back to G-San, and that's where we finished the songs that were going to be on our next record, Ill Communication. But there was that one track left, Chris Rock. It had to be dealt with. I decided that it would be funny to write a song about how Mario was holding us all down, how he was trying to mess it all up, sabotaging our great works of art. So one night I went to Mario's house and he recorded me screaming words into a microphone over that track, all about some mysterious thorn in my side, the ubiquitous biters and the haters.
Sticking to Themes by Spike Jones.
So this next chapter is a more of a photo chapter, but I wrote captions. So since I can't show you the photos through your ears, I'm going to just describe them and then I'll read the caption afterwards. They're good photos and they're all sort of photos from like, I would say mid to late 90s. And it was just my time hanging out with them and making videos. And so these are the captions to them. The first photo is of me and Mike and Yauch shopping for wigs and mustaches at this wig shop over on the east side of Los Angeles, and it's probably the best photo ever shot. I met Adam and Adam and Mike in 1991, and I shot these photos of them for Dirt Magazine, this magazine I had with a couple friends of mine. The guys were working on Check Your Head at the time. They'd always been one of my favorite bands, so of course I was really nervous and excited to meet them. But over the next couple of years, I got to know them better and hung out with them a lot in their studio, making stuff with them and helping them out and making stuff and just getting ridiculous. There was always something bubbling up creatively around them, and if you were lucky enough to be close, you'd get sucked up into it, which was a dream come true for me in my early 20s. Okay, the second photo is probably the best photo ever shot of the Beastie Boys, and it's at Hamburg Hamlet in 1994 in West Hollywood. And what I wrote was, they were always playing, and it didn't matter what they were doing, making music, playing shows, making videos, or getting dressed up in disguises for no reason. It was just all play. And I got to see how they set up their lives too, like how building their studio, G-Sun, and you know, how they dealt with their label to ensure nobody could fuck with them. My photos and videos of them give a sense of what it's like to be one of the lucky ones that got sucked into their orbit in the early 90s. The third photo is of Jason Lee doing a kickflip to pivot up on these ramps that they built in Atwater Village at their studios, G-Sun. It's from around 1993. And it's the best skate photo ever shot. They had a studio, G-Sun, in Los Angeles, and that was the hub of it all. You know, they had recording equipment, skate ramps, basketball hoop, just everything in there. And it was usually a free-for-all, people stopping by, hanging out to skate or eat or fuck around. It was unusual for a band that well-known to have that kind of setup. I thought it was so cool that with the record label money, they made a place where creativity was built into the walls. They weren't just making records, they were making worlds. And they always did it their way. There was never anyone from the record label around telling them what to do. They just made their thing, and then once it was all done, the photos, the videos, the record, they gave it to the label. The fourth photo is Yauk gluing on a mustache on Mike D while we were making the Sabotage video. And I think this one's actually the best photo the Beastie Boys ever shot. The other one that I was saying was the second best. This one's now the best. Once we discovered wigs and mustaches, it was over. Everything they did was always no frills, too. That was the coolest thing about Yauk. He knew how everything was made. He'd make videos, he took pictures, he made music. So he knew you didn't need big, fancy Hollywood crews and budgets. Everything he did was so homemade and handmade. And I think you could feel that it was made by these people. It was all very pure. In those first few years I was hanging out with them, I had just started making music videos. So when they asked me to make the video for Sabotage, it was a big deal. I was very excited. I wrote up the treatment from an idea we had while eating lunch at Hamburger Hamlet, which wasn't much more than, we were making the opening credits for a 70s cop show, Sabotage. We need lots of wigs, mustaches, and a cop car. We submitted it to a production company I'd starting to work for, and the budget they came up with was $85,000. Yauk was like, no, it shouldn't cost $85,000. So Yauk and I went in and had a meeting with the people who ran the company. We were like, we don't need police officers, we don't need to close down streets, we don't need makeup trailers. So let's cut it down to its bare bones. And they said, well, this is the way videos are made. This is the way we do it to ensure that we can deliver you what it is you want. And Yauk was like, okay, we'll do it at a different production company. Then they're like, wait, hold on a second. And instantly $35,000 got cut out of the budget. Yauk wasn't going to be told how or what to do by anybody. He was a true original and punk always. And he really inspired me to keep that attitude in everything I did, no matter what world I was working in. The next photo is of Horowitz wearing this insanely sexy suede fringe 70s jacket and Mike putting on a fat suit as we were figuring out the wardrobe for the Sabotage video. And this, I was mistaken before, this is actually the best Beastie Boys photo ever shot. For the Sabotage video, my friend Casey Storm brought in racks of clothes he got at thrift stores, and he'd actually never done styling before. He was just a friend of mine and we didn't have that much money, but he had good style. So I was like, hey, you want to be the stylist? And he was like, okay, what do I do? And I said, you go to thrift stores and buy a bunch of clothes that would look good in a 70s cop show. And he totally got the aesthetic and crushed it. So we went to his apartment and we started trying on different outfits and wigs, and we basically created all the characters in his apartment that day before we shot. The next photo is of Yauk dressed kind of as a Hesher, and he's got his shirt unbuttoned and a big Hesher hairdo and mirrored glasses. We're in somebody's office and he's answering their phone at their desk, looking like a real sketchy dude. And this is by far the best photo of the Beastie Boys ever. This one, actually, now that I think about it, it's right up there with one of the top photos in the world, but I wish I could show it to you. And the caption is, me and Mike and Yauk found this place in the phone book that was a wholesale wig warehouse, and we went over there, and there was no real store there. It was just a warehouse and a front office where they took orders over the phone. We were in this woman's office and basically told her what we wanted, and she pulled wigs out of the warehouse, and I don't think there was one wig or mustache she showed us that we didn't buy. We cleaned the place out. We had a real wig and mustache addiction at the time. Okay. Oh, wow. This next photo actually is the best photo the Beastie Boys ever shot. I hadn't seen this one before when I said that. So this one is as we're shooting the Sabotage video. We basically drove around town, and wherever we'd stop, they just, in the parking lot, put on new clothes and be the other characters we set up. And we didn't have any trailers. So this photo is Mike in a parking lot, just in his underwear and boxers and socks, putting on a different outfit with his wig and mustache. And Yauk has his wig and mustache and is just leaning against the car waiting for Mike to change. And the caption is... Oh, actually, I said the same thing in the caption, but I'll just say it again. I'm sorry to bore you guys. Basically, we made that video, and really all the videos we made in The Way Yauk and the almighty Nathaniel Hornblower, the great Swiss director, worked. And also in the way I'd made skate videos before, just driving around town, stealing locations, getting dressed in parking lots, eating in the van. We had no permits. We would just see a spot and say, oh, let's grab a shot there. The next photo is a selfie of me and Yauk, and we're in tuxedos in a casino. And this is by far, well, it's not a photo of the Beastie Boys. It's by far the best photo of me and the Beastie Boys ever, ever, for sure. Oh, and the caption is, right after El Communication came out, the guys were about to go on Lollapalooza tour, and we wanted to do a more collage-y video after we'd done the Sabotage one. I always loved the Pass the Mic video, so in a way, this was riffing off of that style, a collage of shots and just running around. I would just write down shots, performing in front of an airplane, swinging from a camera, hanging in front of a crane, you know, things like that. And then we would drive around and shoot stuff. So when they went to Vegas to rehearse for Lollapalooza, we all went with them and shot a bunch of the Sure Shot video that week. At one point, we wanted to shoot inside a casino, but you're not allowed to. So we rented tuxedos and covered the red light of the 16mm camera we had with tape. And I held the camera down by my leg and pointed it up backwards at the guys, and they walked through the casino behind me, and we basically stole the shot. And it seemed very important to me that we stole that at the time. It seemed very important to me at the time to steal as many shots as possible. Actually, it still is. Okay, the next two photos don't have captions, but one of them is Mike D in a mullet wig driving Money Mark's van, sort of truck van, and Money Mark is playing keyboard in the back of it as they're speeding down the street. By far, best photo of Mike D and Money Mark ever made, for sure. Trust me. And the next photo is Mike with a mullet wig and he looks like he's like Canadian from 1974, and he's just trying to buy beer. He's got like a down jacket and a knit hat. And I guess since he's Canadian in this photo, it's a knit toque. Best photo of Mike D ever. For sure. This next photo is a photo of me and Yauk and Mike D. And it's from 1994. And Sophia had a prom-themed birthday party. And me and Yauk and Mike went as the weird, creepy teacher professor dudes. We have, like, suits on and wigs and mustaches. And, like, I have a double-breasted jacket. And, I mean, we all just, like, look like creepy teachers, basically. You know, that went to the prom. And the caption is, so basically, once we discovered wigs and mustaches, as I was saying, we just couldn't stop. You know, we go out in disguises every night, and Yauk had eventually curated this incredible wig and disguise collection in his closet. And, you know, we'd go out as Heschers or weird professors, like I was saying, or really whatever, like just like fat, greasy men. I put Vaseline all over my face and just look really sweaty. We'd end up meeting people as these characters and then going wherever the night took us. I guess if it made us laugh, we would just follow that. The next photo is of Adam Horovitz. All he's wearing is his super tight Speedo, and he's got a giant Miller light beer, like a giant one. I've never actually seen one that big. And he's by a hot tub. And I don't know, I hate to say it, but it's the best photo of Adam Horovitz ever shot. And the caption says, oh, maybe this one got cut. All right. Well, anyways, you'll have to take my word for it. Because even if you have the book, you won't see it, but it's by far best photo of Adam Horovitz ever. The next photo is of Mike D as a sort of Guitar Institute student with a sort of long rocker mullet, and he's basically salivating over these guitars in the guitar What's it called on Sunset? The Guitar Store. Guitar Center. He's salivating over these guitars in the Guitar Center window on Sunset Boulevard. He's got a real puppy dog look, and it's by far the best photo of Mike D ever shot. The caption is, in another article for Grand Royal magazine, Mike D explored the mullet hairstyle craze that had died in Los Angeles 10 years earlier. The best part of this day was taking pictures of Mike with a guitar in a bag hanging out at the Guitar Institute. And the Guitar Institute's this school for like techie guitar players, like really techie, noodly, like that kind of, you know, they were mostly in metal bands. This was like mid 90s, like sort of after the metal band thing wasn't even around anymore, but they were all there, you know, studying devoutly for their break in the metal business. And so at lunchtime, all these kids hung out in front of the school and Mike D basically blended right in. He looked just like them, hanging out with his guitar in front of his guitar school. Next photo is of Mike D again in a wig. All my photos in this thing are of of us all in wigs. I think I have some photos of them not in wigs at some point. But anyways, this is a photo of Mike D in a tuxedo and a beautiful blonde coif in a fancy restaurant, and wow, it really is the best photo of Mike D I've ever shot. I mean, this isn't even my hyperbole at this point. I'm just blown away. But there's no caption for it. So anyways, that's the photo that's in here. The last photo is of Adam Horovitz and Yauch, and they're just sitting on Yauch's bed in his apartment. Adam's got a guitar, and Yauch's got, you know, talking on the phone with the old school phone, and papers are sort of strewn around the bed, and we're just hanging out, I think, playing or working or making stuff up in Yauch's apartment. This is from around 95 or 96 at Yauch's Prince Street apartment. And the caption I wrote was, I loved Yauch's apartment on the corner of Prince and Mulberry. It was one room, tiny, barely big enough for a bed and a sofa. Yauch had very few things, very few possessions. The only expensive things in the whole apartment were his bass and video projector and screen, which was a really high quality theater quality projector. And he had this amazing DVD collection. He was living super simply, making music, watching movies, snowboarding, and going wherever his creativity took him. And really having no limits to what those ideas may be. I mean, at one point he came back and he said that he wanted to make a music festival to support Tibet. And it was something none of us were at all even thinking about. There was something really simple about the way Yauch always lived, almost like a creative monk. Creativity was his guide, leading him wherever it would, with no rules. His friends were his travel mates, riding with him to places they would never have gone to on their own. And I know at least that was true for me. So thank you, Yauch, and thank you, Beastie Boys, for bringing me along on your ride. Those three friends will always be magic to me.
Syncopation Magazine, April 1994. In review, Beastie Boys. Ill Communication. By Tim Willoughby. Read by Will Ferrell. The first thing you notice in appearance about these three Beastie Boys is how strikingly unstriking they are. They're neither tall nor short, handsome nor ugly. In a crowd of people, they would easily blend unnoticed. And within their musicianship, they're not particularly skilled, nor are they particularly awful. Rather, they embody all that is mediocre. Yet, to my surprise, as well as that of the entire music journalistic community, they've managed to create a new recording that some refer to as pretty good. At first listen, I was underwhelmed. I was easily distracted. Time passed neither quickly nor slowly. I was at home making a soup, and so I assumed that I would have enough time to listen and make notes, and then get back to what I was doing. But this record is a full-length LP. Full-length meaning, to me, a little too lengthy. There are 20 tracks here when they should have weeded out the weak and let the strong rise to the top. In this case, there might have only been 4 tracks left on here, and I'm sure contractually that would not be enough material to constitute a full-length LP. And so here we are. Beastie Boys, Ill Communication, and its 20 tracks. The lead-off, Sure Shot. Certainly you've heard similar songs on numerous occasions. A very talented jazz musician's work being synopsized to a one-bar pattern and repeated to such a degree that it undermines all that musician has accomplished. Then layer three vocalists, shouting words that rhyme alongside a drum pattern, and you have popular music's current trend, rap music. I was surprised, however, when the next track, Tough Guy, began. This was a totally different musical direction, and ultimately unrefreshing to my ears. This song is that of the hard rock or heavy listening genre. Your basic format of drum, bass, guitar, and a lead vocalist shouting. A format made so popular by the Beatles, it has persevered throughout the generations. I recognized the capacities of this song immediately and felt staying around for it was superfluous. So I walked from my desk and went to the kitchen to check on the soup. This unfortunate song concluded well before I expected it to, and so that at least was somewhat of a positive. The next song, B-Boys Makin' with the Freak Freak, was so noisy and disjointed I stayed in the kitchen to find my good ladle for the soup. I had purchased it on a recent trip to Luxembourg for the Gehayen Ugref von Jazz. Music and cooking have a symbiotic existence in my home. To my mild delight, the next song, Bobo on the Corner, commenced soon upon my return to my desk, an admirable attempt at creating that space where music and improvisation can lead you toward one's inner-outer mind-body concord. Whereas the attempt is mundanely middling, it is, nonetheless, adequate. We now move on to the next track, Root Down. I quite like the original version of this song. Jimmy Smith, during his Verve Records era, walked among the greats that caressed 88 Keys, Brahms, Rick Wakeman, and a handful of others. Beastie Boys, here coattailing on Smith's brilliance, receive a nod of acceptance from me because of their recognition of true virtuosity. The next song has the same title as an album I reviewed a few years back by a rock and roll group named Black Sabbath, Sabotage. The song is really just a... Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. I smell smoke coming from the kitchen. Okay, whew. It's fine. I was melting butter for a mirepoix to fill out my soup and it just overheated. I cleaned out the pan and started over. It's fine. Where was I? Right, track 7. Get It Together. This, so far, is a standout track. The groove is very interesting, but most notably, a fourth voice is now heard. The voice is listed as someone named Q-Tip. He has a smooth yet bookwormish cadence to his voice that lends to the essence of jazz itself. I look forward to hearing more of this fellow in the future. Track 8, entitled Sabrosa, is yet another attempt at instrumentation by way of heavy groove. While yet again it is commendable that the band harkens back to the days of formidable pioneers of the genre such as Stuff, Exception, and Simtek and Wiley, they fall just short of exceptional. I only barely heard the next few songs, The Update, Futterman's Rule, and All Right, Hear This, as I was in the kitchen working on my ajiaco cubano, a delicious soup I discovered when I was visiting the home of a balloonist friend of mine in Cuba during my autumn break in 67. My trip was overshadowed by the death of Che Guevara, and as an American, I felt it was awkward for me to stick around, and so I finished out my travels in Jamaica, where I had heard wondrous new rhythms and horn sections, drank red stripes until dawn, and learned to make an enchanting oxtail soup. Upon my return to the States, via Toronto, I heard a remarkable violinist making his way into the jazz circuit, Michal Urbaniak. Which leads me to the next track from Ill Communication, Eugene's Lament. This song is by far the standalone track from this album, and is reminiscent of the glorious Urbaniak himself, whom I had the pleasure of meeting and spending time with during the recording of Body English with Ursula Dujek. By no means his best album, but there's a true musical ingenuity that lies within his body of work. Flute Loop is the next track on Beastie Boys LP. I rather enjoyed this track, most notably because of its playing time. It falls just under 2 minutes long, which I feel is the appropriate length for a person of the young generation to speak their mind. There were some other songs that played next, but I was distracted by straightening up my apartment. As I have a few guests coming over for my bi-monthly soup and readings of my poetry gatherings. The titles, so you have them, are Do It, Ricky's Theme, and Heart Attack Man, which was so noisy I had to turn my stereo down. The songs that followed were The Scoop and Shambhala. Shambhala piqued my interest, as I am an enthusiast of the Far East and its mystical ways. Although I've never traveled to India, I feel as though John Coltrane took me there in my formative years as a student of jazz. The final two tracks, Bodhisattva Vow and Transitions, were a pleasant surprise to me. It's as though Beastie Boys is headed in a new direction, one of interflection and calm. I was exhilarated when this album came to a close, as my doorbell rang and the first of my guests arrived. It was Judith and her new husband, Don. Judith was my longtime colleague at Syncopation. She was with me during those now distant days and nights with Michal Urbaniak. And I guess after all these 20 songs, I'm interested in discussing our time together with him, with her. And maybe in some way, this Beastie Boys album will make its way into tonight's conversation as well. Tim Willoughby. Beastie Boys' Ill Communication is set to be released through Capitol Records on May 31st. Available on record, cassette, and compact disc.
Who at This Table Sucks Dick by Michael Diamond and Adam Horvitz. When most New Yorkers talk about the dunk, they're talking about the famed John Starks posterization of Horace Grant and Michael Jordan in Game 2 of the 1993 Eastern Conference Finals at Madison Square Garden. But for us, the dunk will always be the 6'3" Billy Corgan brutally flushing over the 5'9" photographer Ricky Powell, who was also high on mushrooms. It was nasty. Well, what happened was, in early 1994, while we were finishing Ill Communication, Lollapalooza asked us to play that summer's tour with Nirvana headlining. We loved Nirvana, thought they were amazing and important, and we were immediately in. Then Kurt Cobain died. The sadness and the loss of Nirvana at the top of the bill gave us pause about the whole deal. Without Nirvana, we thought Lollapalooza was just corny, straight up, a name-brand MTV alterna mosh party. But then the festival organizers came up with the idea of us co-headlining with Smashing Pumpkins.
We were still interested in seeing what the lineup would be and how much money we'd make and how it would all play out, so we had a meeting. It was us, our booking agent, Don Muller, our manager, John Silva, his partner, JC, a couple Lollapalooza representatives, and this guy, Billy Corrigan, who was the singer of this band we'd never really heard of that was taking Nirvana's place as the headliner. And also, there was the founder of Lollapalooza, Perry Farrell. I love Perry Farrell. He's fucking bonkers, a genuine weirdo. We're all sitting at this table in Hollywood at night outdoors. It's a pleasantish and grown-up evening, and Perry's getting drunk. It was kind of inspiring how little he appeared to be worrying about the right way to act or the right thing to say. The rest of us were talking about bands we wanted in the lineup. We were throwing out bands that we like that we're also kind of friends with, A Tribe Called Quest, L7, Boredoms, and a couple others. Billy's telling us what he likes, and after a while of going back and forth, Perry sits up and says loudly, "Who sucks dick?" Wait, what? Who at this table sucks dick? None of us really knew how to properly respond. Then we realized the point he was making was that all the bands we were suggesting were super straight bands for straight people. A broad generalization, but he was looking out for gay kids who didn't want the usual rock music. Ultimately, the lineup didn't reflect what he had in mind. I'm not sure what he actually had in mind. I feel like he might have said Morrissey, and we all said that'd be awesome to tour with Morrissey. Or did he want Bette Midler? Again, would have been fucking amazing.
Anyway, the lineup ended up being us, Smashing Pumpkins, Funkadelic, The Breeders, A Tribe Called Quest, Nick Cave, L7, Green Day, and Boredoms on the main stage, with numerous other bands like The Far Side, The Verve, The Flaming Lips, and Luscious Jackson on other stages. It was a full-on traveling circus, because we'd gotten a say, Billy Pumpkin had gotten a say, and Perry had gotten a say. There was all manner of different shit going on simultaneously at any different time. Starting with, on the main stage, the day's festivities got underway with Tibetan monks chanting. Yauk's idea. If that wasn't strange enough, the monks were followed by Boredoms, a brutal and assaultive noise band from Japan. Backstage could be a lot of fun too, especially the pickup basketball games. Billy Corgan did not exactly have handle or a crossover move, but he was tall and surprisingly competitive, demonstrated by his thunderous dunk on Ricky Powell. There was Fife Dog, rest in peace, from A Tribe Called Quest, driving through the backcourt, and guided by voices chucking up threes. On one pleasant summer afternoon backstage at the Bay Area's Shoreline Amphitheater, I guarded Fife. A crowd had gathered to watch. He was sweating, running the court up and down in Timberland boots. Eventually, he got frustrated with a few things. Also, he was 5'3", so he had to really muscle or elbow his way anywhere near the rim. Eventually, he went up for a shot, and I had to reject that shit. After I did, Fife gave me an icy glare that made me wish I had never guarded him in the first place.
Also backstage somewhere on the tour, a UPS delivery person walked in with a package. It was kind of quiet in the room/tent. Then she took off her UPS hat and said to us, "Dude, I can't believe that worked. I borrowed this UPS uniform from my friend, came here with a clipboard and an empty box, and security just let me walk right through, and now I'm in the fucking Beastie Boys dressing room." So yeah, of course we gave her all the tickets and all access passes she wanted. Oh, and one time we gave The Verve a ride on our tour bus, and the singer told my brother that his father was a time traveler. And that was Lollapalooza.
Like a fanzine, but on a computer. Hi, my name's Ian Rogers, and this is how I showed Beastie Boys the internet. I grew up in a town of 20,000 people in northern Indiana. My stepfather studied computer science, and we had an Apple II in the house when I was 8 years old. By age 10, I was an assistant instructor at an after-school computer programming center. I'd been obsessed with music since age 5, and through skateboard mags and mail order, I found Minor Threat, Black Flag, The Misfits, and Bad Brains. I knew Beastie Boys as a band on the New York Thrash Roar cassette. I never listened to License to Ill in the 80s, but Paul's Boutique hit the bullseye for me. I became obsessed with that record in a way we don't get obsessed with albums in the streaming internet music age. Memorizing every moment, identifying and making mixtapes from the samples, noting and looking for hidden meaning behind each lyrical reference. When I went to college in Bloomington in 1991, I bought a used IBM 8088 XT clone with an amber monochrome monitor and quickly discovered Usenet. International internet message boards where nerds from around the world wrote endlessly about whatever they were into. I'm sure Usenet had professional uses, but I used it for the same reasons I use Instagram today, music and skateboarding. I contributed to Usenet in the two ways I was most qualified, transcribing and posting David Bowie lyrics, and maintaining the Beastie Boys Frequently Asked Questions, or FAQ. For the Beastie Boys FAQ, I dutifully determined what the important questions were, made sure they were answered, and posted the organized document to a Usenet news group called alt.fan.beastie-boys once a week. When the Mosaic World Wide Web browser was introduced in 1993, I moved the Beastie Boys FAQ to it. The World Wide Web was a much better information repository than Usenet, which was fundamentally designed for discussions. Here's what you have to realize. There wasn't anything cool or sexy about the World Wide Web in 1994. All pages were gray animations, layout control, Java, JavaScript, CSS, etc. would come later. It was more about information than interaction. Still, I was obsessed with putting everything I could find on my Beastie Boys website. The Beastie Boys catalog was fun to obsess over. I started scanning and posting every magazine article I could find, because linking to the article in your favorite magazine was still several years away. So the website not only answered your newbie questions, is Screech from Saved by the Bell, Mike D's brother, it also tipped you off to all this stuff you didn't even know existed. While I'm sure the audience was infinitely small by today's standards, the Beastie Boys website was one of the few must-see sites for people just coming online, and that distinction made me all the more determined to make it definitive. Still, the notion that Beastie Boys, or anyone they knew, would ever see the site seemed absurd. I was no lawyer, but I was pretty sure the scanning of magazine articles and appropriating of logos and images wasn't legal without permission. So when I got a call from a woman named Beth Ann who worked with Beastie Boys, I was stunned and pretty sure the next step was a cease and desist. But when I talked to Beastie Boys manager John Silva, he said, "Sue you? No, I want you to do this for all my bands." Not only did he not shut me down, he offered to pay me for the time I spent on the Beastie Boys site. I was making $6.50 an hour working at the IU Music School library at the time, so I went in for the kill. I asked for $8.50 an hour to build websites. By the summer of 1994, I still never had any contact with the band members themselves. One day, I got a call from Beth Ann offering me tickets for Lollapalooza. I'd seen Beastie Boys a few times between 92 and 94 in small venues, like a cow barn in Indianapolis. I didn't really have any interest in the big festival, and I would have been embarrassed to meet the band in a corny, "Hi, I'm the nerd who made a shrine to you on this thing you've never heard of called the World Wide Web," kind of way, so I thanked Beth Ann for the offer, but declined. She called me back a week later saying the band wanted me to give them a tour of the site. They've never actually seen the internet, and they want you to show it to them. Okay, in that case, I'd love to come. This was my first time ever having special access to anything. Yauk volunteered to show me around. We played basketball and rode skateboards. I played one-on-one basketball with Billy Corgan. I have a vague memory of George Clinton feeding me spaghetti off of his plate. The entire day was thrilling, but we were more focused on hanging out than talking about this internet business, and we ran out of time. I failed at my mission to bestow the wonders of the internet on Beastie Boys. Yauk had the solution. Come to Detroit! I jumped in the Beastie Boys bus headed to Pine Knob Music Theater. This time, we had an appointment to get down to business, and after I hooked up to a modem in the production office and installed some software, we all huddled around Mike D's PowerBook Duo, trackball and all, to catch a glimpse of this new thing called the World Wide Web on the internet. Mike, Tamara, and Yauk were in the room, along with a couple members of L7, Matt Sweeney from Chavez, and Lollapalooza co-founder Mark Geiger. No one in the room had ever laid eyes on the internet, except for Geiger, who was pacing around the back of the room insisting, "Guys, in a year you're going to sell all your records this way," and Sweeney, who knew the URLs for black metal sites in the Netherlands by heart. Despite my lackluster presentation, Mike and Yauk got the potential of the technology immediately. They saw the value of a direct path to Beastie Boys fans without MTV or radio in the middle. On the spot, we decided to put their magazine, Grand Royal, online and take the out-of-print first issue and make it available in its entirety for free on the web. It was like a fanzine, but on a computer. Later on the bus, the band's then tour manager, Wilf, sat down and asked me how I was doing. "I'm having the time of my life," I said, "but I can't figure out why these guys want me hanging around." "Oh, that's easy," replied Wilf. "They think this internet thing is important, and they're trying to figure out if you're going to be helpful or if you're going to be annoying." "How am I doing?" "You're doing great." And he walked away. A few weeks later, someone named JC from the management company called. "We're going to need you in LA for pre-production in March, and we need a budget." I told him I thought there was some mistake. Mike just asked me for an idea, and I gave him one. "Y'all should totally do it," I said. "I mean, I don't even know how to do it. I'm still in college." JC calmly said, "You want to do this, kid. We'll figure it out." We built video game machines out of classic junked Space Invaders and Lunar Lander machines I found in Indianapolis and had trucked to Los Angeles. We begged Apple to give us hardware. We put joysticks on the front and used QuickTime VR Studio as an interface to launch loud videos from Beastie Boys, DJ Hurricane, and other Grand Royal artists. We put loudspeakers and big monitors on top of the video games to make them a spectacle on the concourse level of the venue. They were cool in 1995, and even if they existed today, you'd have to nod your head and give it up. Shit was dope. Nerdy, but dope. In those days, you couldn't say, "Check out my website," because maybe one out of every 100 people had ever heard of one. So on the 1995 tour, we launched our own grassroots campaign to get people to try the internet. We handed out floppy disks at the shows.
Kids, do not hand out floppy disks at your show. Morons will throw them at you.
If you put them in your computer, they signed you up to an internet account, white label ISP through Spry, and dropped you right on the Beastie Boys webpage. Finally, on that 1995 tour, we pioneered the idea of posting live from the show. no mobile internet, so I was taking photos with an early Apple QuickTake camera, running backstage and uploading grainy photos over a phone line, while my best friend from college, Mark Thompson, wrote sarcastic stories about every show and every city we traveled through. That's the story of how Beastie Boys became internet pioneers, and I started a career in digital music. We did the tour diary again for the Hello Nasty tour, built the first online radio station for a label at Grand Royal, achieved the first day-and-date digital-physical album release without the drive-in's relationship of command, reissued every album in deluxe box sets online with director's commentary in 2009, and more. From my perspective, this story shows you a lot about how Beastie Boys worked. They were visionary and quick to explore something new, always making it theirs instead of using what other people were doing as a template. They could have worked with professionals, but instead they preferred to support a kid from Indiana they thought had some potential. They worked at it, but had fun with it. And I'm proud to have been a part of early internet history in exactly this way.
The Summer of Os Mutantes by Adam Horovitz, read by Chloe 70. 1996. I was madly in love with my new girlfriend and future wife, Kathleen. The California life had run its course for me, and I had to get out. It was time to come home. Yauch had already left L.A. and was fully back in New York, living in a fucking tiny apartment on Mulberry Street, right in the thick of Little Italy's yearly San Gennaro Festival. More specifically, his window looked down onto the Drown the Clown booth. So every day during the festival, from morning till the end of night, there was some fucking guy barking at people to spend their money throwing balls at him to humiliate him and make him fall into a dirty little bucket of water. Just to shut him up. The annoying shit that you hear and see out of your New York City apartment window is its own book of stories and lists. The past few years we'd been living in Los Angeles, and when we come back to New York, it was as though we were just visiting. We recorded some music there in 94 and 95, but felt disjointed from our city. I love Los Angeles, but how many sunny days in a row can a true Yorker take? So we moved home. And when you move, you start hanging out with new people. And when you make new friends, you end up hearing new music. Or new to you, at least. Enter Os Mutantes. I don't know who told me about them, but when I heard their song, Penis et Quinces, it instantly got bumped up to the top 50 of all time. It was a psych rock sound I kinda heard before, sort of, but it was coming from a different geographical place, further expanding the notion of, if they're making this music over there, what else are they doing, and who else is doing it? We got pretty deep into bossa nova and other Brazilian music. I already had the bigger, more classic records, the ones that had made it in America. Sergio Mendes, Herb Alpert, even Jobim and Gilberto. But no one had ever hit me to Jorge Ben, or this fucking Os Mutantes record. Soon enough, I was on a new musical hunt. Not just for breaks and beats, but sounds. Lucky for me, I didn't have a job to be at, so I had a lot of time to go hunting. I started to get back into old electronic records, Moog records, digging a little deeper than the few switched-on records I had. Taking the real sonic plunge into Morton Subotnick and Jean-Jacques Perré. Who knew that Gershwin Kingsley made the song Popcorn? And how was Hot Butter's version of it the biggest record when I was 6? Everyone loved that song. Put it out now with the shack up beat, 808 kicks, and some crazy trap hi-hats, and you have a hit record. When we moved back to New York, it seemed different. A little. It was changing. While we were gone, a lot of strangers moved in who seemed to have extra cash to buy funny hats and shoes at these new fancy boutiques in what used to be forgotten neighborhoods. All of downtown was mid-facelift and was being given new names like Norbeca or Esso. East of Soho? Or the Future District? But who cares? It was summertime, and New York City summers are the best. We were back and were living a grown-up version of our high school days. Nothing to do but wander around to link up, hearing new music, making new music, hanging out with some new friends, and so on and on. Here's my Summer of 96 playlist. Penis et Quinces, Os Mutantes, Psychedelic Greatness. Silver Apples of the Moon, Morton Subotnick.
This record should have been titled Music to Play Scrabble By. Do the math. The Peaches. Punk Brilliance. EVA. Jean-Jacques Perret. Jean-Jacques Perret getting funky on Moog Indigo. What's not to love? Mira Venaka, Johnny Colon. If someone you know doesn't know what Boogaloo sounds like, play them the song and they'll be like, oh shit, I love this. And they'll go on a hunt for records by the Latines, Ray Barreto, Joe Cuba, and so many more. Love Fingers, Silver Apples. I'd never heard of this band, like Os Mutantes, until I got back to New York. The song has an amazing intro, one that we tried to bite for the next decade. Elevators, Me and You, Outcast. Whoa. Atlanta is onto some new shit. Hallelujah, Can. Smoke a pin joint and walk around New York listening to this song on headphones. Smilin' Billy Sweet, Heath Brothers. This is what we wanted our laid-back instrumental music to sound like. El Raton, Cheo Feliciano. Simply one of the best songs ever recorded.
In 1995, we recorded and released a hardcore 7-inch called Aglio e Olio. We thought it would be fun to start an alter ego band called Quasar, go on a couple tours, and only play our old and new hardcore songs. And a few covers, too. Wonderwall by Oasis, 53rd and 3rd by the Ramones, I Am a Poser by X-Ray Specs, Big Shot by Billy Joel, Red Tape by Circle Jerks, and a couple Bad Brain songs for sure. We played maybe 15 shows in total, but each one was totally memorable and exciting. We toured the west coast of the U.S. and did a few shows in Japan and Australia. We played punk clubs, an indoor skate park, outdoors at the bottom of a ski slope, some dude's house party in Lake Tahoe, and the best of all of them, a cruise boat in the harbor of Sydney, Australia, dressed in a nautical theme. Of course. I would here like to acknowledge the glory that is our longtime friend and drummer, Amory AWOL Smith. He is simply the greatest hardcore punk rock drummer ever. Never to be rivaled when playing the typewriter beat.
Halloween with Lee Scratch Perry by Michael Diamond, read by Elvis Costello. In terms of the way we make records, Lee Scratch Perry was one of our biggest influences for sure. I'd explain it like this. Since the first recorded music, most pop and jazz recordings have been made in as simple and straightforward a manner as possible. You have a bass guitar going through a mixing console going to a tape machine. You have drums mic'd and submixed with few effects, if any. Guitar, vocals, whatever, same. The idea being that you wanted the recorded version to sound as close as possible to the way the music sounded if you were simply sitting in the room while the musicians played it. Fair enough. Lee Perry's approach is the exact opposite. Taking the instrumentation and whatever was being played in the room as the starting point, as his raw materials, he'll then endlessly manipulate and tweak and transform them until they sound nothing like they had in the room, and everything like whatever he has in his head. Usually he does this by using some technology or other, tape delay echo, a reverb that makes something recorded in a closet sound like it's being played inside a giant hall or stairway. An EQ where you'd only be hearing a portion of the frequency of whatever is being played. Loops, layering, feedback, speed changes, playing stuff backwards, slapping and pounding on spring reverb units until they literally created explosions of sound and hundreds of other ideas and effects. Instead of aiming for perfect reproduction, Perry sees the raw tracks as merely his paint, and he is the painter, not the musicians. Like a lot of kids my age, I first saw his name on a Clash record. On the band's first LP, they covered Police and Thieves, a song Perry co-wrote, and he later produced their amazing single, Complete Control. But it wasn't until later, while we were making Paul's Boutique, that we started to buy a lot of dub records. During Check Your Head, we became obsessed with his song Bushweed Corn Trash by Bunny and Ricky, produced by Scratch. The vocals sound literally otherworldly, swirling around like an alien spacecraft, and so much has happened in Perry's chamber of effects that the listener can't tell which way is up. Perry pushed the production and the effects further than we'd imagined possible. And we really wanted to do the same, so his records became the blueprint of how we could get there. When stuck on an idea for a song, we'd ask, what would Lee Perry do? Even though Grand Royal published a huge cover story about Perry, we didn't actually meet him until 1996. Oddly enough, we bumped into him in Hong Kong and had dinner with him. Perry had a video camera and he